This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with industry experts and SG2 thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we all expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery.
Visits do not correlate with the severity of the flu season, but they often correlate with the severity of the previous flu season. And that sort of makes us, I think, a little bit keen on the fact that just awareness and fear can drive folks to the clinic. And this year, that's a big factor.
Welcome to SG2 Perspectives. I'm your host, Trevor Durin. And on today's episode, we're going to tap into the always deep knowledge of Justin Cassidy, who leads our medicine and surgery team. I asked Justin to talk through some scenarios of what the next flu season may look like. We have data from the Southern Hemisphere. We know how abruptly flu season ended when we started social distancing in March of 2020. And all the things that we're doing to attempt to contain COVID-19 should reduce the spread of flu as well. So what's all that going to mean for prevalence of flu this year? And how's that going to impact health system volumes? What is flu season going to look like this year?
And Trevor, I think that the only responsible answer is really who knows. It is a wild card. There's a lot in play this year. All of our listeners have heard about the potential for a quote-unquote twindemic in 2021, that of both flu and COVID-19. Folks are not always aware that you can get co-infected with two or more viruses at the same time. Really important. COVID-19 symptoms are essentially the same as seasonal influenza. There's some little differences, but it is very, very similar. And clearly the severity is more in some folks with COVID-19, but there's a large degree of variation in symptom manifestation. With that co-infection, COVID and flu is thought to be really bad. But in truth, it hasn't really been measured because the way that those two are diagnosed is sequential. That is, if you do a diagnostic, you get a COVID positive upon hospitalization, you stop diagnosing oftentimes. So folks aren't even tested for the flu. And that's actually a bad thing because there are medicines available for treatment for seasonal influenza, can be used in the hospital setting. We think that dual testing should be the norm down the road. There are also other approaches, other countries, especially where radiologists have called for CT scans to even potentially diagnose and differentiate the two or to determine those that are comorbid. So really a lot in play here.
Now I'm going to make you walk through a couple potential scenarios of what that could mean for the upcoming fall, for winter 2020-21. What could a couple of the scenarios look like for the magnitude and scope and impact of this upcoming flu season?
Scenario planning is really essential. That's what we're encouraging SG2 members to do. There's no hard and fast number. There's so many things that can change. Social distancing measures can have a huge impact in the onset. They can curtail a flu season. If relaxed, can cause it to exacerbate potentially. There are four scenarios that we can work through. The optimistic scenario, the kick the can scenario, the pessimistic scenario, and the K-shaped scenario.
I can imagine a couple, but lay them out.
The optimistic is there's no flu surge. Social distancing, travel restrictions, universal masking, work from home, school from home, less public transit, less vacations, less travel abroad, completely curtails flu season. Less than 12,000 died of the flu in the 2012 flu season, which was the least severe in the last decade. And there were fewer than 140,000 hospitalizations that year. So maybe it'll be even less than that. If so, there's not much of a problem. It is important to note there's still more of a problem, even in the optimistic scenario, than what folks are experiencing right now in their hospitals. You have to have some sort of a plan, even in that most optimistic scenario. Makes sense, Trevor?
Yeah, I'm optimistic.
Now let's take a turn for the worst. It's the kick the can scenario. And this is the idea that even in the optimistic scenario, there will eventually be a point in time where there will be both flu and COVID circulating in the community. And the reason is that the COVID vaccine is more likely than not to be partially effective, kind of like the influenza vaccine that's only about 40-45% effective in a good year. With widespread community transmission at this point in the United States, eradication of COVID-19 is increasingly unlikely. So the silver bullets we're looking for may never come in play. So if we don't get a relaxation of social distancing, et cetera, in winter 2021, then it might happen in 2022, 2023, or whenever things reopen, and then we might get that twindemic. A kind of bleak future, but maybe likely.
Okay, so optimistic short term, but that doesn't save us from a twindemic down the road.
Exactly. That's important from hospital planning perspective. As you're thinking about enacting new testing regimens, the third scenario is the pessimistic scenario. What's more pessimistic than the kick the can? The kick the can will still probably show curtailed severity of transmission for COVID-19, which is kind of great. But what if there is a huge surge this year? What if quarantine fatigue sets in real early? We think that there's not much infection outdoors, but indoors, there's a much higher risk. Well, in the winter, people still want to get out of their homes, offices, houses, et cetera, and reengage with each other. They just get too lonely. And so bars, restaurants, and travel may reopen earlier than not. With the sort of hygienic practices that are in play now, we all know that you can't make the entire world an operating room. Sterilization costs are real high. It's a pain to do properly, easy to skimp, especially when you're not paid very much. Those sorts of measures are probably never going to be as stringent as they are right now. What does a bad flu season look like? We saw this in winter 2018. We saw 61,000 deaths from flu that year and over 810,000 hospitalizations, according to CDC data. So this is really severe flu season, and it could potentially be even that bad.
Justin, the people who died from the flu, does that mirror some of the comorbidities that we're seeing in terms of mortality from COVID-19?
Absolutely, especially aging. That's number one. Older Americans are much higher at risk. They always have been. Your immune system ages just like the rest of your body. It's harder to turn on in the first place. So by the time your immune system gets started, there's already a lot of virus in your system. And then once the virus is around and your immune system is active, it's also hard for your immune system to stop working. It's less nimble. And that can lead to conditions like sepsis and really kind of a problematic, land you in the ICU, really complicated types of inpatient admissions.
All right. That one doesn't sound too good. Is the fourth scenario even worse than that?
Well, the fourth scenario, unfortunately, is the most likely. It's also pessimistic. And this we're calling the K-shaped scenario. The K-shaped scenario is reflective of the health disparities that are in play. And so what we saw with the COVID-19 pandemic in March, April, when a lot of the country was shuttered, was essentially a plateau of cases in many major cities. And that surprised a lot of epidemiologists at the time. It was actually a tale of two cities, if you will. There were those that were sheltering in place, and then there were also essential workers and those experiencing social determinants of health, illegal immigrants and so on, that were not able to socially distance and not as willing and able to engage with health systems in the first place. So a lot of folks were spreading in the community that really couldn't prevent it, unfortunately, for a variety of means. We think that that might happen actually this year with
those same folks, essential workers especially, may not be socially distanced. They might have even experienced COVID-19 infection in the first place and feel like they're less vulnerable,
but they're still vulnerable to seasonal influenza. We also know that reinfection of COVID-19 is formally possible, may not be that likely, and it may show curtailed COVID-19 symptoms, but we still don't know what it'll look like if you get, say, reinfected and have influenza infection. If those folks end up showing up at your emergency department, they may be not insured. That could really affect your bottom line. The other important thing to note here is that testing and treating with those antiviral flu medications could really help save lives, but also could help your bottom line by reducing that length of stay and potentially unreimbursed ICU costs. There's certainly something to be aware of here.
Yep. And the payer mix erosion that's been accelerated from big spike in unemployment seems like it's going to hit that same population particularly hard. That's scary. What do we know from looking at that historic data about what a typical flu season looks like and how this might be similar or different?
Every year, the incidence or new cases of flu varies tremendously. And we all know this. It's just worth reiterating. And it's really hard for smart people with many letters behind their names to predict even the strain of flu that's going to circulate. Sometimes there are two that circulate each year. And that's for what vaccine to actually create. So it's hard for them to predict the strain of the flu, much less the severity of the flu. And that incidence of flu is going to be very different from the healthcare utilization associated with the flu. As we know, increased push for consumerism, but also the fact that there's more high deductible health plans than ever. People don't go to the doctor for routine reasons.
things like the flu, if they think that nothing can be done, they may forego those visits. And so there's been a dampening of utilization for influenza in prior years. Some may not know this. Medications for flu can be prescribed, especially for the vulnerable. But even for prophylaxis now, for those that are potentially living with vulnerable people, so you could actually take an antiviral if people in your household are affected to prevent you from getting influenza, which is pretty cool. That's kind of an emerging thing that's happening. There's just a paper published in New England Journal of Medicine about a couple months ago about this, and it's really an exciting new trend. If you're cohabitating with an intergenerational household, if you had the flu, you could actually get a prescription for your family members to protect them if they're very vulnerable from influenza, which is very cool. Change from years past. Our claims data using ambulatory market strategists, the peak starts every year in Q4, and it's a small peak. In Q1 of every year, it's a giant peak. Right now, in the summer, we're experiencing a lull. Clearly, this isn't top of mind right yet, but that Q4 peak is coming down the pike. Every year, the utilization ranges by millions of visits. And interestingly enough, when I was digging into this, those visits do not correlate with the severity of the flu season, but they often correlate with the severity of the previous flu season. And that sort of makes us, I think, a little bit keen on the fact that just awareness and fear can drive folks to the clinic. And this year, that's a big factor.
That makes a lot of sense. What we've seen in the last few years is that even flu vaccine compliance is only around 50%. Now, we've seen guidance emerging that I think the flu vaccine is just becoming available now. I've seen some national guidance saying, no, wait to get the vaccine until October or November, closer to when that peak you were talking about really starts. So what are some factors that could make compliance with the flu vaccine higher or lower this year?
Flu vaccine compliance is around 50%, and it varies by the year, certainly varies by a lot of other demographic factors. Those that'll be driving flu vaccine compliance up will probably be just fear, could also be infectious disease wokeness. Now the entire country is clearly very well aware of pandemics and infectious disease and is hoping to avoid them. Also could be a push by payers and employers. And employers, and this is really kind of a legally contentious thing, certainly I'm not a lawyer, but so far as I understand, employers can legally compel their employees to get vaccinated. And that is going to be a big issue, not just for influenza, but as the COVID-19 vaccine rolls out in November and December. And I think for our clients to note, for their workforce, those COVID-19 vaccines are going to be available for healthcare workers probably first. And there may be folks that don't want to get vaccinated. A lot of contention right now in terms of efficacy and safety. This is something almost to be discussing with your medical ethicist today. And then there's some that are going to probably prevent flu vaccine compliance this year. Number one, lack of trust, the amplification of the anti-vaxxer movement and rumors. Number two, the idea that the mask makes you invincible as you engage with the community. And you folks, we've already seen the Chicago area, just in my neighborhood, no need to socially distance if you're wearing a mask. But that might be good if you're outside. But if you're indoors and you forget to socially distance, that could be tricky. And then finally, the most important, it's something we're calling ambulatory contraction. That's where there may be lower primary care and chronic care in-person visits. And here we can draw our SG2 forecast into play. We are actually projecting overall 30% fewer primary care visits this year. And that's just a tremendous number. That's 100 million fewer visits in 2020. So there's been this huge uptick of virtual health, as we're all well aware. Speaking of almost a cliche, you can't get a vaccine virtually. About 90% of vaccinations are happening from primary care visits, 10% of visits from chronic care visits. But again, those are in person. 80% of all visits are done in offices or clinics, and the remaining 20% done in other sites of care, retail clinics, supermarkets, etc. If you go to a retail clinic or pharmacy, get your vaccine there, will you start to actually go there for other types of services that are increasingly being offered in those settings? I know Henry and team have been talking a lot about Walmart Health being a tremendous disruptor, sort of commodity types of services like vaccinations. Will that have a lingering effect here as folks are trusting those settings more and more?
Imagine the greeters when you walk into Walmart saying, hey, you should come grab a flu shot if you haven't.
It very well could.
Without a doubt, more people getting the flu vaccine is a good thing, right? It's going to make them hopefully less likely to get both the flu and COVID-19 at the same time, and it could limit the number of people in the community getting sick just from the flu. What proactive strategies can health systems pursue to just encourage people to get the flu shot, which obviously then can be replicated and mirrored if and when we have a COVID-19 vaccine?
Yeah, this is really the question. And I think that here's something that we encourage folks to be creative. Number one, I mean, something that could encourage people, it may not be the best strategy, but certainly could work, is fear. Don't want to make people too afraid. I think folks are already really very reticent.
Are you thinking like a bank sign that, but instead of the temperature, the hospital says how many COVID patients they have at a given time?
Yeah, I mean, I think just reminding folks that influenza is incredibly deadly. And that's something that we kind of do forget. The significant mortality every year. And maybe we shouldn't be accepting that moving forward. The second is to build trust or use trust that's already established. And this is really the example of your pediatrician or if you have a primary care provider. That's really important. Someone that's trusted, they can give you proactive outreach, maybe an email, text message, et cetera, however you're pinging your patients and reminding them that they do need to receive that influenza vaccine. I actually just yesterday, ironically, received a voicemail from Walgreens saying that I should get a flu vaccine. It was extremely impersonal, but it was at least a reminder.
Sure. I've noticed the grocery store and Walgreens starting to advertise free flu shots.
Absolutely. I would trust my PCP way more than Walgreens in terms of that. But that trust is starting to erode. In some cases, the primary care model is certainly not as strong for younger generations, millennials and Gen Zers especially. As you're moving from employer to employer, or unfortunately, if you've been fired or furloughed, you may not have that same provider in play and as an option. The other and really important is to encourage our public health authorities at whatever level. It may not be federal, it may be more state, or maybe even very hyper-local. That's really important that they're making frequent and often calls for vaccination. Every government official should be making that play because it'll preempt and flatten the curve for the flu. I think the most important, it's not the what in terms of the message. It's really who is giving the message that should be changed. And here we should be seeking out trusted community advisors. Again, those established relationships with individuals, religious leaders, as you're having your Skype weekly religious meetings, that's a tremendous potential trusted advisor. The other is untraditional folks. In Chicago area, Chance the Rapper actually had tremendous outreach for COVID-19 stay-at-home orders. And coming from someone that kind of looks like you, that you are trusting for other types of activities, coming from an unexpected source may actually heighten the volume of awareness and attention of the message. In terms of strategy, we're really encouraging our hospital clients to be creative. Nursing homes would be really huge bang for your buck. Finally, it's the how of how those services are delivered. It's really important. You're doing vaccines, but it might not look how you have in the past where folks come to your lab and do it. They might be reticent to be in a waiting room. So have the option to deliver vaccinations via waiting in the car or having a drive-through clinic. University of New Mexico has a great example. They've been doing that for years for seasonal influenza vaccines. You don't have to have an appointment. You can just drive right through. Thinking about kind of coordinating and coupling those perhaps with COVID-19 testing tents that you've already set up in temporary spots in your community, that could be a great sort of double dip. Also could be used down the road to serve for a COVID-19 vaccine strategy. Or sending out vans or mobile units to care for vulnerable communities that don't necessarily have that sort of transit.
All great suggestions, and I'm with you. I think the smart folks at our members can come up with just as many creative options that are going to work in their markets. So thanks for sharing this much, Justin. And thanks, of course, to our listeners. Please subscribe or follow if you want to hear more. And I recommend you also check out another Vizient podcast, The Modern Practice. It's on Vizient's medical leadership channel and provides a clinical perspective into current issues affecting healthcare today.
This has been another great episode of SG2 Perspectives, where industry experts and SG2 thought leaders explore the drivers of tomorrow's healthcare strategies to inform today's decision makers. Contact us anytime by sending an email to sg2perspectives@sg2.com. We'd love to hear from you. SG2 revolutionized healthcare demand forecasting with the Impact of Change forecast, and today we're the industry's premier strategy advisory firm. To learn more, visit sg2.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.